and welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
This week, we're talking about quality and how we can deliver quality software.
So quality software, that's what the QA department's for?
Quality is everyone's responsibility. I heard, I think either on a podcast or on a YouTube video or maybe just on Twitter, I might have read that you're not paid to deliver code. You're paid to put code into production. I would take that a step further and say you're paid to deliver value. And so whether that is write code and produce some functionality and put that into production where it is being useful to someone or some process, or if it's just a configuration setting or it's a new manual process of pencil and paper.
Yeah, companies don't want code. They want, or they think they want software because they think that it can solve a problem that they have or optimize a process that they already, that's in existence. They don't actually care about the code at all.
Stepping back for just a minute, what are we trying to define when we use the term quality?
The first thing that always comes to my mind is quality software is software that does what the company needs with limited breakdown. So, I mean, bugs happen. You can't get rid of all the bugs, but five nines worth of operation is really what we shoot for most of the time.
And I would also add to that the ability to extend that code into new functionality that the business might need. So you want the software to remain software and not just another form of hardware, even if it can stay running as hardware, right?
So something that will continue to deliver value as the needs of the business change.
Correct.
So by that, do you mean that it's something that's easily maintainable and easily extendable, or what more do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think so the maintainability and extendability sort of are where those two pieces are what I'm talking about. I think that you just it needs to be able to be modified, right? So whatever, either add features to that or modify the way that system, some things that are integrated with it. There are definitely different ways of going about that, right? You don't necessarily have to change the literal code that's running. You could add, it could be a part of a system where you could extend it by adding other modules or other pieces of code, right? The way that you maintain it, but the code itself has to be able to be maintained and extended and sort of flex with whatever new requirements or however the business changes, how the world changes, how because code really, once it's written, the computer should be able to continue doing that exactly the same way for forever. I mean, assuming you don't have things like, memory leaks and other issues, right? It if it's quality code that's running well, it'll run for forever. But if you can't change it, then you're going to have to go and stop that code to introduce a new system. Because that the old one was too inflexible.
It sounds like you've kind of been answering the question of why clean code matters. Clean code is a term that any followers of Uncle Bob would be familiar with, but it basically means code that is maintainable and flexible enough to change with the business needs. Are there any other reasons why clean code matters? So other than keeping up with the business, why would clean code matter?
To Ash's point, I think it has to do with maintainability and extendability. I've written down a quote here to be sure to put in our show notes, attributed to Ben Franklin. The bitterness of poor quality remains long after the sweetness of low price is forgotten. Clean code and quality code is cheaper because it is maintainable and extendable. It is hopefully easily understood. It's easy to get to fall in the rut or to fall in the mindset that I'm going to slap something together and push it out and then call my job done and then, you know, leave for the day, pitch it over the wall to a QA department or just go ahead and ship it to production, right?
Yeah. So maintainable by others. It's like after you've quit or retired or hopefully not been let go, the people, the developers that come in behind you would be able to work with that code without having to speak with you first.
And even for future me, because I mean, there's been multiple occasions where I've come in a day later, a week later, a year later, and picked up some code and say, oh my goodness, what is this mess that this previous jerk left for me? Only to look at the commit history and see that the jerk was me. So, you know, I want to make sure that I'm doing right by my future self or anybody that comes after me, that I'm going to do the best I can from the beginning so that I don't make a mess early on.
Do the best for those that come after us, even if it's ourselves, so that they don't have to pay for the sins of their forebears.
Right. A number of years ago in my first home back in Louisville, Kentucky, I wanted to build a double thick sound deadening wall to build a home studio for musical recording, guitar and drums and stuff. And a friend of mine offered to come over and help me because I really had no knowledge of how to go about constructing any kind of wall. So he came over and really took over the project for me. And I thanked him immensely for this. We measured more than twice and for a single cut. Because he instilled in me that you want to start as precisely as possible, because the further along you go in the project, a little imperfection early on is going to cause just ripple effect of waves and waves of differences in the future. So be as precise and as clean as possible early on so that you don't cause yourself a massive headache in the future.
Yeah, a 44 degree cut means that the whole wall is sideways.
Or angled or something. Yeah.
I think there's also, I mean, there's an element of quality. I mean, we're talking about clean code, but there is an element of kind of the benefit of quality that comes from more of the bug side of things. You know, is the application from the user's perspective, you know, what's their experience? You know, anyone using a buggy application has a really bad user experience. They become very frustrated with the system as it doesn't behave like they're expecting it. Sometimes they'll find workarounds or ways to deal with that, but that obviously is generally going to be bad for the business. And it doesn't really matter what kind of nice UI or clever, you know, graphics and whatnot that you've pasted on that. You know, a bad buggy experience kind of is going to be a bad thing. And it's going to ruin any of those things. So, you know, from having making sure that the application does what it says it can do and does that in a predictable and consistent manner, that's an element of quality, which doesn't impact us necessarily directly, but it is also really important, which we talked about it, but it's sort of why it's so meaningful to the business.
There's another side effect of code that's maybe not the best, and that is something that any senior developer has probably experienced when trying to solve a new problem or understand a framework. I myself have gone into when I was trying to learn Angular 2 and understand its patterns that needed to be worked with, I would do a small test in a certain part of the application, and very quickly there were 40 instances of a pattern that turned out to be a really bad pattern because the other developers saw that and just went, well, he's the senior or he's the tech lead or he's been here longer. We're just going to copy that.
Or just that works, right? Like,
yeah. That must be the right way to do it or something. So that leads to one of our topics, which is bad code begets bad code. And I think that there's a flip side, is that good code begets good code. Whenever a developer enters a system, there's a high chance that they're going to copy the patterns of that system, either for good or for bad.
And just as a side note, and in general, that's sort of, I would say, something that we actually I would encourage people to do in general. I mean, there is a point where you might need to, you're trying to improve the system, so you go against the grain, but you have to be very, you need to know when it's appropriate to go against the grain and when it's not going to be just cluttering up your system with a lot of different styles and formats. So it would be much preferable for people to follow the patterns that have been sort of in place.
Yeah, and I agree to a certain extent. I do feel like we should always be trying to right the ship.
Absolutely.
If you're implementing a pattern because you've seen it in the system and you know that it's already something that they're doing, you should not blindly implement it. Maybe implement it and think about it and either ask the other developers if they think that it's a good pattern or suggest something that might be different. And or depending on your team, maybe just make a slight tweak that you think will be better. I don't think that we shouldn't experiment in the codes, you know, a little bit, especially when learning something new, but we should be careful about just blindly implementing whatever it is that we've seen. Legacy systems, greenfield projects, like they're all, everyone should be, I would hope, trying to get better all the time. So no code is ever going to be exactly the same. There's a pattern that John and I have used for years, the repository pattern. And it's probably been through at least 50 or 60 iterations where we've improved it or swapped out a piece because the framework changed. Lots of little changes along the way. And now John can go into a company and just drop that pattern in and instantly be productive. And that's really what we should be shooting for. We shouldn't be writing over and over and over the same exact code all the time. Any other issues with using the patterns that you've seen in the software? I mean, what are the side effects of that?
Just to touch on that very briefly, you know, the first half of my career or so, I was essentially a maintenance programmer. So I would come in on existing projects and pick up whatever had been developed before I got there and make modifications, make enhancements. So, you know, I was wholly trained by existing code bases. Hopefully, I was learning from those that were professional and did the very best that they could at the time. I think for the most part, that is accurate. I think I saw a lot of quality projects and learned a lot of good practices and different patterns that I normally wouldn't have learned. Making a good code base will help train your developers and help train future developers. Another aspect of bad code, though, is that bad code can often hide bugs in a system. You know, if you're opening up a class or a file that's 3,000 or 4,000 lines long, names are poorly chosen, you know, it's very difficult to get a grasp on what's happening inside that particular file, that particular class.
Yeah, well, I'd like to add to that in that, given the nature of software development, I think compared to other industries, there is an exceedingly high turnover level for not only developers, but also the business analysts and the project managers. So any job you go to, the knowledge base of how the thing is supposed to work in the first place is pretty limited. And I've worked at several companies where a bug, like an actual bug in the software, became a business rule that they depended on. So that's another issue with those, you know, that bad code hiding the bugs is that nobody, you know, whoever came up with the requirement in the first place didn't realize that there was a bug there. And the developers didn't see the bug because it was hidden in some file. And then over time, as people rotated out, it just became the way the software worked.
Yeah, good or bad, that's how it works. And if I'm coming on to a project looking at a legacy system, I'm expecting that it behaves the way it's supposed to behave. So I would be very cautious about changing any existing functionality.
We've got an application at work right now, and the users of the application are like, this is terrible, we hate it, we need to change it. So the developers go, okay, we'll rewrite it. And a particular developer that was working on it said, okay, you don't like it as it is, so I shall try to make the user experience better. And they switched from like a chopped up Bootstrap plus custom. They tried to switch it over to Material Design and update the controls to be more user-friendly and try to fix some of the UI bugs that were happening. And the initial feedback was, this doesn't behave like the existing application. We want it to look and behave just like the existing application.
And another issue with bad code is that bad code costs money, whether that's in maintenance or rounding off fractions of a penny and putting it into a bank account. I did, in fact, work on a project many years ago that rebalanced monthly payments in a nightly transaction system. And after months and months of it behaving badly, it turned into what we affectionately called the $250,000 problem. Come to find out, it was more than just $250,000 was missing from their balance sheet as a result of badly behaving software. It ended up being over $1 million before we really tracked it all down.
That is crazy. I want to extend that one, though, because I think that this particular one transcends simply the software. You could basically say bad insert word or word phrase costs money when you're dealing with a company. So even if the word or word phrase isn't specifically the developer's job, as a professional, it's still the responsibility to try and eliminate the bad.
Whether it's bad code or bad design or bad architecture or bad behavior.
Right. If your architect tells you to do something that you actually think is a bad move, then have a discussion with them. If your designer tells you to put unicorns and pink rainbows all over the application, if you're not in that kind of business, then you need to have a talk with them. And if the business analyst or product owner, depending on your style of development, if they hand you a requirement and the requirement doesn't make sense or you think is not good for the business, then you should have a discussion with them about that. Same thing for bad code. Have a discussion with the developer or have a discussion with yourself if you're the one about to write the bad code.
Yeah, it's all about professionalism at that point, right?
Right.
So how do we ensure that we are delivering quality, whether it be quality software or just quality in general?
That one's kind of tough. So there is certainly, and we talked about this a little bit in our care and feeding of developers, there is a certain level of knowledge or wisdom or whatever you want to call it that you will pick up over time. And without that knowledge or wisdom, it is difficult to know when you've crossed the quality boundary and gone over to the bad side, the dark side, if you will. So you will have to develop that. And that takes time. And if you have a mentor, great, because that can shorten the amount of time. If not, it's a hard won battle. But there are other things that we can do that are pretty simple. Like, don't rush through a problem is a simple one that anybody should be able to figure out. You know, it's speed kills. And faster kills faster.
Yeah, I like that one a lot because I've worked with a number of developers recently who say, wow, you code so quickly. You can solve a problem so fast and deliver on a feature very, very quickly. I said, no, I think about it as, you know, for a day or two or for all night long through, you know, on my commute, I'll think about the problem that I'm trying to solve. Once I'm sure that I understand the feature that I'm about to implement, then I'll go about writing the code to implement that feature. I'm a big proponent of test-driven development, so I'll start with the easiest test that I know that I must implement to make sure that I am satisfying the criteria as I understand it. And then I just knock out those tests, and then I write the code that I know that will satisfy the tests, and then I'm delivering the feature. Once I start coding, that process happens very, very quickly because I've practiced that for a number of years. What isn't often witnessed or isn't as tangible is the hours and hours of forethought that I put into it to really make sure that I understand the problem that I'm about to address.
Right. And the tools and patterns that you have developed in the past and kept in your bag of tricks to solve certain classes of certain problems so that, you know, like if you recognize that this problem can be solved with that pattern, you can just reach into the bag, pull out the solution for that pattern, and you're ready to go. But if you had to start from scratch without that pattern, then you'd be just as unfast as everyone else.
Unfast, I like it.
I would extend that to even, you know, things like names and having the time you sort of sit and think about that. I mean, I don't know how many times I've written something and in that refactor set, hey, do I need to rename this? Renamed it. And then two iterations later, I'm naming it something else different because in the back of my mind, I'm still mulling over, is there a better name here? And then, as you've been doing that for a while and you've been, you know, working on that, you know, incidents where it, you know, you're naming things, a lot of things get repeated in our line of work. I mean, and so you come across a similar situation. You're like, oh, what was the name that I used the last time? Okay, this is going to be a similar name and it's going to be very specific to those sorts of things.
Yeah, I've been questioning some of that lately because I end up with a lot of foo service and bad service. And I'm like, service is not helping in this situation. I should probably just remove it. But, you know, internally, I formed that pattern a while ago. And so my nature is to go straight back to calling something a service, even though it's not helping.
It's good to question that, and right. It's good to follow those patterns. It's sort of like what you're talking about with the bad code begets bad code, good code begets good. Following those patterns, those are sort of like internal patterns that we've set for ourselves. It's good to follow those things, but don't ever implement a pattern, even if it's something that you've done yourself, without questioning, hey, is this the right thing to do, or can it be improved? And if there's opportunity to improve and drop service because this is not meaningful to me, this is not what this is doing, right? Find a better name and use it.
Yeah. And looking at the video feed here, sorry about that to those listening on the podcast, but feel free to watch it on YouTube as well. Just looking at the books behind you there, Ash, and then my bookshelf over my shoulder here, you know, there's also a fair amount of reading and studying that we all have continued to do, to continue to learn and grow and refine our craft. So what other tips and tricks to ensure that we're writing quality software?
Well, I know you guys are all familiar with, but the Boy Scout principle, which is sort of make sure that you leave the code better than you found it, is a really good way of cleaning up code. Doing the small incremental changes are much more impactful and a better approach almost in every situation than a massive rewrite or a massive sort of fundamental shifting of that of the situation. It's obviously better if you have some tests or something like that can make sure that whatever you're changing, you're not removing functionality or whatever. But I think that's been a huge principle for me to kind of take a system that doesn't have quality and say, how do we move it towards the end of quality?
Or even systems that had quality or have quality, currently have quality. It's just we did more reading or we had more discussions with the business, with the client, or we just, you know, thought about it. And I think it needs a different name or this pattern needs to be implemented here, or we just need to break up this monolithic class into something a little bit more manageable. You know, it could have been the best code that we wrote yesterday, and there's probably still going to be room for improvement today.
Yeah. There's almost nothing in the world that can't be improved in some fashion. I would say that the caveat is that the question you have to ask yourself is the effort that I'm putting in to making this better delivering the value to make it worth it? If the code is working and it's fulfilling the business need, and let's say it's clean enough, but you think this name could be a little bit more expressive, if you're already in that file and you're making changes, by all means, update the name. But if you're just bored and it's Sunday, don't go in and start changing the code, because you could confuse your team by doing that. But you do want your team to be in the mindset of, while you're in a space working, feel free to tweak the space to make it a little bit better than it was when you got there.
Yeah, and I would say if you start down this rabbit hole and it becomes a little too daunting, if it's going to be a larger body of work to implement the changes that you first started on, then, you know, maybe back that out. Maybe just add a task on your backlog and say, this is the idea that I have. Let's discuss this and see if it's worth the effort Let's come up with some ideas of how we might tackle this and make that improvement in the future, because we don't want to start, particularly if we're on a deadline or working inside a sprint, we don't want to start on something that's going to take us away from delivering the features that maybe might make the most sense to deliver the quality, to fulfill our commitments. We want to make sure that we're focused more on that, because you know that's what we've committed to.
Yeah, I've made the mistake of going into a legacy application, and they wanted me to make some minor change, and I like testing my code as well as the both of you. So I was like, I'm going to make this class testable. 3 hours and 30 files later, I decided maybe it wasn't the best idea, and I should go and see if there was another way that I could work with that particular file. ended up, I created an external interface, and I made the interface testable, and then I could test, and the file became kind of bleh.
But it's important to say, don't leave the half done effort. Don't comment it out and leave it there. Don't leave it there in place half done.
So this is a little bit out of order in the notes that we have, but is this an opportunity for a to-do comment here, or what's your thoughts on there? Because I certainly have strong feelings.
Why don't you go ahead and say your strong feelings first, and then we can respond.
So, I guess I would say that there's never. I mean, I wouldn't say. There's opportunities for to-do comments if those are part of your planning for the work that you're doing. But in the situation like this, where you say, okay, I've gotten into something that's too big, I want to implement this later, it's not, I see a better thing here. Go make a note in your, so whatever your backlog is, whatever the work item, whatever the work items are, and bring that, put it in there and let it get scheduled for the rest, and don't clutter up the source code with a to-do. That would be my, I think I'm with Uncle Bob, expunge all comments that aren't absolutely necessary.
Yeah. Comments are just a failure to convey the meaning that you were intended to convey. Right.
Yeah.
But I think we're more or less on the same page. I will leave myself a to-do comment. If there's something that I'm going to address that day, I will leave a to-do comment for myself. If there's something that's going to last more than a day, then I'll have a hard time doing that. If it's going to last more than a couple of days or into another sprint, I might leave a to-do comment. I will add an item on the backlog if it's something that will not fit in this sprint but needs to be addressed in the next sprint. Then that's probably where I would be doing that. These types of comments for me might be, this is a larger feature that has been broken up into multiple stories. If I'm implementing part of the feature and come to a point where I know the next feature that needs to be implemented, here's a hook into it, or here is where I might put it. I'll probably leave a comment to that effect there with a link back to the backlog item. But if it's something that's going to live more than a sprint or a sprint and a half, a to-do comment is going to be useless, because something else higher priority will come in, and it'll get knocked off the radar, and it'll be lost deep inside the code somewhere. And then 6 years later, that to-do comment is a complete lie.
Yeah, I would say that my opinion is somewhere in between the two. So I don't use to-do comments a whole lot, but when I do, it's usually because I've got a story that should have been broken down a little bit further, but for whatever reason, it wasn't. Maybe we didn't think that it was going to be that big of a deal, and then it turned out that it was. So I will leave a to-do comment more like planning steps. So I'll comment like, here's step one, step two, step three, step four, and then I'll go slap a to-do in front of all of them. And then as I write the test and the code to fulfill each step, I will wipe out that to-do comment. And then from that aspect, I feel like, for me at least, to-do comments are fine to commit, but they are not fine to merge. So I will not leave a to-do comment in a merge, not intentionally anyway.
That seems fair. Yeah, I mean, it does keep, I mean, committing, you want to commit early enough, maybe for using Git. So, seems that's. I mean, I think that both of you guys, I mean, as much as I said I had strong feelings, I would say it seems reasonable. One of the things I think that is a huge kind of tip or trick or whatever is to really focus on naming. It's to me, naming is sort of like in cities trying to manage crime, they focus on the little tiny things. And the idea is sort of like, if we keep graffiti off the walls and we keep glass, you know, windows not broken and things sort of upkept, it drives the amount of crime down because it's sort of, it leaves things out of place. And names, I think, are the broken windows of bad code, if you will, the graffiti of bad code. They're really simple and easy to change most of the time. And especially early, they're easy to change when you're first working on them, but they're really hard to get right. Sometimes they can be very difficult. And so if you're focusing on the naming, you'll want to improve the other things. But if you have sloppy, bad names, it makes it really difficult to want to fix the other parts of the code.
I feel like talking about naming kind of gets into the Maslow's hierarchy of needs for developers. You know, like you said, names are the broken windows, right? So when you're at the top of the hierarchy, then your code reviews are being picky about syntax and spacing and this name doesn't make any sense. But when you're in the trenches at the bottom of the hierarchy, you're just like, this code doesn't work. Like if it ran, I would totally merge it, but it doesn't run. I think we should actually put together, if it's not already out there somewhere, we should put together a Maslow's hierarchy of needs for developers. But that's kind of how I feel about naming. Naming is definitely one of those things that is great to focus on. But if the rest of your code is broken, then naming may not be the most important thing to think about right now. It definitely helps when you come back later or when the next developer comes into that code and they're trying to work with it, if the names make sense.
Yeah, and building on names, I think code organization as well, you know, putting classes in folders that make sense and segmenting out solutions out into different projects. Clayton, you had mentioned in a previous episode your rule of 3 to 5 or whatever that was. Maybe you can kind of briefly explain that, but I think that goes a long way. The organization and the naming will go a long way that shows you care. So of course, the system is going to at least compile and hopefully run and do the thing it's supposed to do, to where we're focusing on what are seemingly small, minor things like naming and structure and organization, because the larger things, the functionality, we've got that down pat. Now we're just making sure that everything is clean, neat, and tidy.
For anyone not familiar with, I'll summarize the rule real quick. Basically, when you're writing your application, if you do it incrementally, then when you have somewhere between 3 and 5 of anything, so 3 to 5 methods, 3 to 5 classes, 3 to 5 folders, it's time to start thinking about breaking stuff out into the next level. If after folders would be projects, and then after projects, I guess you're in multiple solutions, but somewhere between 3 and 5 is manageable. Somewhere above 5 is unmanageable. And so it's a good idea to start thinking about breaking things out at that point. I want to throw something in that kind of pairs with organization. It's not in our outline, but there is it's a psychological thing where when you walk through a doorway, your brain kind of dumps out on the floor and you get a fresh perspective. So literally leaving the room and coming back, you get a fresh perspective on whatever it is that you're trying to solve. One trick that I have found useful in writing better code is actually the Pomodoro technique. So you work for 25 minutes, you take a 5-minute break. When you come back from that break, your brain has been refreshed. So when you sit back down at your desk and you're like, what is it that I was working on? You get to look at that code as if you didn't write it and you realize how terrible it was like right away. And then you can go refactor and so on. So that's something that I would suggest anybody who can manage it. It's a really powerful technique. It also helps get a lot of work done in a day.
All right. So any final thoughts before we start to wrap up here?
I would say kind of the overarching suggestion here that we've made is always try to do better than you're currently doing. I mean, that's what all of those things are for. So if you focus on trying to do a little bit better, trying to be a little bit better developer, a little bit better person, a little bit better whatever every day, then you should improve over time and people will really see the impact.
Yeah. So I would just say a little bit at a time, right? Goes a long way. Sort of the key thing, kind of seeking after that improvement. I think earlier we mentioned kind of experience really helps. If you don't have the experience, you don't have the wisdom already, then it's going to be difficult to sometimes be able to determine, is this quality or is this not? You have to be seeking after that wisdom in order to get it. You can't just, life experience won't just get it. You have to be open and ready to learn. So you have to be sort of in the pursuit of those pieces. So you have to be working towards it, but then you also have to be doing a little bit, adds up a little bit at a time. Don't feel like you have to get it everything all at once. And that's
all right. And we want to hear from you. If you out there in Radio Land have any tips and tricks for us or for the rest of our listeners, then hit us up.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.